Now, with me in studio this morning are, if I can find my list, which of course is here, Mary Cross, former ambassador, now chair of the Future of the EU 27 Committee. That's at the Institute of International and European Affairs. Rona McCrae, professor of constitutional and European law at University College London. John O'Brennan, Jean Manet, professor of European Integration, Maynooth University. Shona Murray, Europe correspondent with Euronews. And Paul Somerville, markets analyst. And also, very importantly, a once upon a time person who lived in Japan, more of which and on, to find out how that went. Anyway, we will proceed with Mary. Where do you? We'll start with. I suppose we have to start with Brexit.
Oh, do we, Mary? Yeah.
Well, where would you prefer to start?
No, we might as well.
Well, it's really looking. I suppose it's not about, it is about Brexit, but it's about the amazing series of things that happened this week.
Yes, I mean, this week has been extraordinary in the events. Trying to keep the focus on Brexit, I mean, it has been pulled to the side in some senses with the constitutional judgment. We've had the Labour Party conference, so those were two issues that kind of pulled it a bit off the,
yes,
off the front pages. But we're still back, despite both of those, we're still back looking to know where we go now. It's extremely difficult to know how the British government are going to proceed now. I suppose we're waiting to see the Tory party conference, if there's going to be something that will emerge from there. But it's very difficult to see a path forward. Our government keeps asking for reasonable plans that would replace the backstop, and some pieces of non-papers are being put forward, but nothing that's adequate enough. So what are the possibilities that Prime Minister Johnson would go after the Tory party conference with something nobody's thought of? Because the only thing that's on the table is the withdrawal agreement and the political declaration, which is tracking in some considerable detail the way forward to a trade agreement, and also explaining another paper, explaining the Irish backstop. What would replace that? It's extremely difficult.
Perhaps just a northern backstop?
That really is probably the only option that you would have the withdrawal agreement.
DUP wouldn't approve of it, we can be fairly sure.
Well, it's a question of whether you would get full-scale support for that among the other parties. And that's obviously a question that European member states are asking themselves. No matter what is given or what is agreed, can it, in the situation in Britain, get agreement?
There was a very interesting ad in the Sunday Telegraph today, a very, very big ad and a very kind of well-produced ad across two pages, Clean Break or a Bad Deal. And this was an ad for the Brexit Party. And it's an extraordinary ad. First of all, it's unusual, but also it's during the Tory party conference. And who's seeing opportunity where? Rona McCrae.
Well, I think the really interesting thing really is how Brexit has now consumed the institutions of British politics. The Conservative Party is now just a Brexit party. It's defined by that issue only. They don't care about their old fiscal rectitude. They just care about Brexit. The Liberal Democrats only care about Brexit. Mm-hmm. Labour, which is trying to have some kind of middle course, is being destroyed by trying to have a middle course. And in a way, then you see, it's like, you know, in Northern Ireland, every general election is actually two elections. Sinn Féin and SDLP on one side and then UEP and DUP on the other. Mm. And in Britain it's the same. There's an election between the Conservative Party and the Brexit Party that Nigel Farage is trying to win for himself, and there's another Remainer election between Labour and the Liberal Democrats. And the two sides aren't even talking to each other anymore. And it's looking like the British system, its constitution, its the role of Parliament, the parties are all being consumed by this one issue. And there's a lot of brouhaha about the court ruling, but actually it doesn't make that much of a difference. We're stuck in a holding pattern, waiting for the election that will decide it.
Yeah, people were getting very exercised because Mr. Johnson said that he didn't agree with the judgment. You don't take issue with that.
Well, he didn't agree with the judgment.
Yeah.
He didn't say it in a very graceful way. The Attorney General normally is a bit more reticent. But on the other hand, three senior High Court judges did agree with the Attorney General's advice, and the Supreme Court disagreed. So I don't think that's a resigning matter. Mm. Doctors differ, patients die, lawyers differ.
It's the dying bit we must worry about. Yeah.
But I don't think that it's such a total scandal.
Right. No. Okay, just come back to that ad, because there's a reason for that going in today and a lot of money spent on it, and it's the Telegraph, which is Boris Johnson's paper. What did you make of it, Shona?
Well, Boris Johnson's paper, of course, but what's interesting is the language again is that, and Boris Johnson was interviewed on Mar today talking about getting Brexit done, a clean break. I mean, it's incredibly mendacious. There's no such thing as a clean break if you were to go by Boris Johnson's promise, which is to leave the EU by the 31st of October and defy the law. Because as we know, the UK would find themselves outside the EU treaties and trying to re-engage on all of the issues that are contained within the withdrawal agreement, protection of citizens' rights, etc. They'd still owe the £39 billion towards the EU budget, or you'd find universities and everybody else outside all of those provisions. So it would actually create even more chaos and acrimony if that would be the case. And in addition to that, if you look at Philip Hammond had a piece in the Times yesterday talking about, well, there's questions as to why Boris Johnson and people like Nigel Farage want this so-called crash out or clean break, whatever way you want to look at it, and that is to do with their backers who have decided that they would bet on, you know, the pound crashing, and that they would...
Can you explain that to the betting system?
Yeah, very, very interesting, because from an Irish perspective, it's hugely important because of the Irish banks. They're actually betting against Irish banks rather than... So a lot of people listening would think, well, you know, we've heard about if you think sterling's going down, you'd bet against sterling.
Yeah.
You know, that seems quite straightforward. But sterling is very volatile. For an example, sterling's up 5% since mid-August. And that's because the markets are starting to perceive that something else might happen. But just to explain this, if you want to make money out of a no deal, you need to bet on negative consequences. So you would expect share prices to fall. So you bet on them falling. Now, what complicates...
The share prices, bank share prices?
Yes, well, that's what complicates things, because, again, a novice investor would think, OK, I might give that a go. But if you bet against UK shares, because they're listed in sterling, sterling is going to fall, so those UK shares will probably go up. So you're not going to do well out of that, even in a no-deal scenario. So what you would normally do, or what hedge funds are doing at the moment, is betting against Irish banks. So, for an example, if you've got AIB...
Oh, genius.
Yeah, so AIB share price is down 50% from the IPO. You know, that's in the middle of 2017. It's down about 60% from the high. Bank of Ireland is down 53% since the start of 2018. And what hedge funds are doing is, it's more lucrative if there's a no deal to bet against Irish banks than UK banks, for exactly for the currency reasons, because they're quoted in euros. So I hope I've explained that well, because I know it's complicated. But if I'm a hedge fund manager, I know that if I'm betting on a no deal Brexit, I'm better off to bet against the Irish banks rather than UK shares, because
they remain in euro.
Because they're in euros and not in sterling. So it's very intriguing, because Philip Hammond, you know, he's the ex-chancellor. He just came out yesterday and he said Boris Johnson is backed by speculators who are betting billions on a hard Brexit. There's only one outcome that works for them, a crash out and a no-deal Brexit. And I think you can see that with how Boris is acting.
And it was corroborated by his sister, Rachel Johnson, who actually said the same thing.
Yeah.
So the other question is, so what happens next?
Can I just come back to this for a moment? Because this country has gone through a fair amount of pain over the last 10 years. Do you remember that story, The Big Short?
Yes.
The book, and then subsequently the movie.
Yes.
This is the same thing.
Well, it's just a way...
Sean, I'll come back to you.
Like, so if you're sitting there as a hedge fund manager, you have to think, if you wanted to bet on a no-deal Brexit, which is a scenario that's quite probable, they sit down and say, well, what's the best way to do it? How would you do it? So it's nothing against Ireland in particular. It's because the Irish banks are going to be affected, and obviously Ireland is going to be affected. So for an example, these hedge funds have been making serious amounts of money for the last year, but if you bet against the currency, you haven't been. Because the currency has been fluctuating on every particular statement. And as I say, it's up 5% in the last month. So again, you know, whereas the Irish banks have been consistently going down. Now, I'd like to say that's not the only reason Irish bank shares have been falling, because it's to do with the ECB and negative interest rates as well. But you can see that speculators are definitely targeting Irish shares and Irish banks in particular.
And what are the consequences?
Well, the consequences of, I mean, for us, it's because we own AIB. because don't forget, you know, there was a lot of people who gave out about to Fine Gael because they said that when they were selling off shares in AIB, they sold them too cheaply. Now we're down another 50%. So obviously, if we want to sell shares in the AIB, we won't be able to at the moment. I mean, it's at a very, very low price. The positive news is that if there's any outcome that is not a no-deal Brexit, you would expect bank shares and Irish shares to appreciate pretty substantially very, very quickly. But you can see what, like, it's his sister, Boris Johnson's sister's come out with this yesterday and said, yeah, people who have invested billions shorting the pound and shorting the country have expectations of a no-deal Brexit. So what she's got wrong there is she thinks they're shorting Britain, but they're using the Irish bank shares to short Britain and short and bet on a no-deal.
God, it wouldn't cheer you up. Sorry, Sean, I'll cut across you, then I'll come to you, John.
I guess what the question is, what our options are open to Boris Johnson. He says he's going to leave on the 31st of October, come what may, but you know, he's required to request an extension. It doesn't look like there can be any deal in place when you look at the piecemeal proposals put forward by the British government so far to Michel Barnier. In fact, most sources that you speak to say they've regressed dramatically in terms of the fact that they're gutting the backstop. They have no interest in maintaining the status quo or the commitment essentially to the Good Friday Agreement and the all-island economy. So there's a piece in the first front page of The Observer today which is quite interesting, and it's quoting Keir Starmer, the shadow Brexit secretary, who's saying that Boris Johnson might employ the Civil Contingency Act in 2004, which is essentially emergency legislation used in times of terrorist attacks or wars. That means that he may be able to not have to apply the law under the Benn Act. But, I mean, there's question over whether that's going to be possible or reliable.
It says they can only take measures that are justified and proportionate under that. So if there's a few riots and they try and set aside an Act of Parliament on a huge issue like that, they'd be stopped in the High Court in hours to get an injunction.
Right, OK, John.
But can I say, I think that the real problem for Ireland is the UK is experiencing a full-blown constitutional crisis. Now, this was entirely predictable if you followed the trajectory of events. But for us, I think the real problem is actually not with Boris Johnson and the government. It's the opposition, because the Benn Act effectively brought Parliament back into play, and the Supreme Court confirmed this emphatically on Tuesday. So the real question is now, is the House of Commons capable of cohering around a government of national unity? Johnson cannot get an election because the Fixed Term Parliaments Act requires two-thirds of MPs to vote for it. So, you know, how does he possibly get there? They're clearly trying to engineer a crisis that results in a vote of no confidence and they get a general election by default, but they can't. And I think the real danger for us is the problems between the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats. They are completely at odds with each other. The Labour Party conference last weekend started out with this effort to defenestrate Tom Watson, the deputy leader, which failed. And then on Monday, they had a whole series of motions before the conference. It was completely shambolic. I have no idea what the Labour Party's actual position on Brexit is. They were saved, I think, by the Supreme Court judgment on Tuesday. Corbyn still failed to rise to the occasion. And then we have the Liberal Democrats saying that they will not support an interim government or a government of national unity led by Corbyn. Now, if they continue on that path and they fail to cohere around an individual to lead such a government, potentially, in the weeks ahead, then we are in real crisis territory.
Is it more likely that you'd get someone like Ken Clark, you know, to
may or may not happen. No, thank you.
I think he said he would do it if he was given the opportunity, or if he had to do it, he'd step up to the plate. But I think you're right. The problem is with the Lib Dems and the Labour Party, and the fact that Jeremy Corbyn himself has this position where he said, "Well, we'll do a better deal with Brussels, but we'll also campaign. Some of us will campaign to remain. Some of us will campaign against that deal." And when you look at Joe Swinson's position, which is kind of undemocratic as well, because they're just saying they're going to revoke Article 50 unilaterally and not give people a chance to vote again, which is an extreme position too at a time when you're trying to get some sort of unity or unified position in a very bitterly torn country.
Okay, can I ask you to put on your headphones there, because we're going to go to the phone, because on Wednesday, when the British MPs were back in the House of Commons after the Supreme Court ruled about prorogation, but instead of getting down to business of any real substance, an argument broke out in the House over what some have labelled as toxic language being used by Prime Minister Boris Johnson, which they say is inflammatory and incites violence. Now, an unrepentant Mr. Johnson responded by saying that the best way to honour the memory of the murdered MP Joe Cox was to get Brexit done. Well, Kim Ledbetter is Joe Cox's sister, and she's on the line now. And thank you very much indeed for joining us. It's not as though you, interest in all senses of the word, family interest, political interest, and so on. What was your reaction and your family's reaction to the events in the House of Commons this week?
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
It was a very difficult week for us. We've spent 3 years trying to build a very positive legacy for Joe by bringing people together and lots of community activation and tackling important issues that Joe felt passionately about, like loneliness. And unfortunately, we're now spending our time trying to use her foundation as a way of calming things down, which I think is really important. We were very upset when we saw the scenes play out in the Commons on Wednesday evening. And I think my message and our message as a family is that everybody now needs to take a step back, think about the language they're using, think about the way that they're behaving, and think about how we can treat each other with respect and civility and find a way of moving forwards. And this, for me, is across the political spectrum. If we go back over the past 3 years, we've seen divisive, non-helpful language from people, you know, representing different parties. And we now need to look for some proper moral leadership from both the Prime Minister, the Leader of the Opposition, and indeed all parliamentarians.
That sounds very fine. And admirable. Can you see any evidence of it showing up anywhere? The Prime Minister was on the telly this morning with Andrew Marr, completely unrepentant.
Well, it will only change if everybody is prepared to change. And you know, he did say some things which gave me a little bit of hope in terms of, you know, he does understand the fear that politicians are feeling in terms of their own safety, and it's a very real fear. We have politicians being threatened and abused on a daily basis, and again, this is across the Brexit divide, it's across the political spectrum. I think he has a little bit of time to reflect and has moved somewhere to helping, but he certainly needs to do more.
Did your sister genuinely feel threatened? You know, was it an immediate sense of threat? And looking up the court case and the murderer, like, had she really taken them seriously or done what people sometimes do and say, oh, that's just another nutter?
No, Joe hadn't had any specific threats.
Right.
She'd had the odd bit of abuse on social media, and she'd had the odd bit of, you know, a few bits and pieces, but nothing serious. I mean, I think the reality is this has got progressively worse in the last 3 years.
Why do you think?
I think there's lots of reasons. I mean, Brexit clearly has a huge part to play in that it has not only created division, but it has unearthed lots of issues that I think were already there, people's disillusion with politics, you know, people's problems within their own communities. I think there's lots of issues that have come to the fore. And I think, unfortunately, as I say, because we've had bad behaviour from people in public life, I think there is a lot of anger, there is a lot of frustration in communities up and down the country. But, you know, as I said, the big thing for me now is we have to draw a line under this. And there's absolutely no point going back over the past few years and saying, he said this or she said that, because we've seen bad behaviour and we've seen inappropriate language, as I say, across the board. But we now have to work together to draw a line under it. So we have to find a way through the Brexit debate, but we have to do it with humanity. We have to do it with passion, but also with compassion.
Yeah, I'm just looking at an account of the man that murdered your sister. And as he was doing so, he was shouting Britain first. And he later told the court that his name was, quote, death to traitors, freedom for Britain. And there were special rules attached to his sentence. He got life in prison, but only to be released by the Secretary of State. Now, you have an organisation called What Is More in Common, and that was set up in your sister's honour.
Well, the organisation is actually the Joe Cox Foundation.
Yeah.
More in Common is a local group of volunteers that I chair who have worked at a local level to unite our community and done some amazing things on the ground. But it's the Joe Cox Foundation, of which I am an ambassador for.
Okay.
And we're currently working across the political spectrum. We've got a standard of conduct that we're working on, which we're going to ask this week all the leaders of the political parties to sign up to. We're working
which
with
will include what kinds of things?
The detail is what we're working on. We've been working on it since May,
yeah.
And we probably weren't quite ready to go live with it, but I think last week's activities have forced our hands somewhat. So we're working on that at the moment. There's a draft being done, and it's been done with Lord Jonathan Evans, who is the chair of the Committee for Standards in Public Life. So we'll be taking more action on that this week. But it's really important that everybody signs up for this. And within that, I also include, you know, politicians signing up to a standard of conduct, but also the media looking at the role they play and the responsibility they have. One of my problems or weaknesses is I always try and see all the sides of an argument, but actually that doesn't often make very exciting headlines because you end up with the boring beige, you know, bit in the middle.
Yes.
So I think, you know, and that's how we were brought up. That's how Joe and I were brought up, to think about things from different perspectives, to empathise, to try and understand. And we're not seeing much of that in the political arena at the moment.
Well, it's funny you talk about the newspapers, because with all of the programmes going on, I think it was Boris Johnson's sister, Rachel, who brought up this question of the coarsening of language and the coarsening of discourse, and said it started way back, and she went through the newspapers, and that nobody cried halt.
Oh, well, to be fair, we've been speaking about this issue for the past 3 years, and we've been seeing the way that things have been going. And, you know, we've been trying to use the Jo Cox Foundation to try and highlight this as a very dangerous situation where somebody has to draw a line under it. But you know, you're absolutely right. You can see all over social media things that people in the Labour Party have said, things that people in the Conservative Party have said, and other parties as well. Very violent language, very combative language, brutal and aggressive. And this is why I'm saying it will only change if everybody takes a step back.
Right.
And the media as well, in the terms of the headlines that they use.
Yeah.
But again, I understand everybody's got a job to do. You know, politicians have got a very difficult job to do at the moment. Journalists have got a job to do in terms of selling newspapers and making interesting programmes. But we've all got a job to actually put the country first, right, and find a way of uniting people.
Well, I mean, presumably you'd have a perspective on what is perceived with some reason as Mr. Johnson's strategy, which is to turn people against all politics and institutions.
Yeah, I mean, again, I always try and be objective. I always try and be fair. Some of the things that he said in Parliament the other night could certainly be perceived as a strategic way of causing division. I would also maybe hope that some of the things he said were because it was a very heated debate and he's had a chance to reflect on those things, and I think would look to consider his words and his actions in the coming weeks and months to try and calm things down rather than stoke it.
Oh.
But we've got to, you know, he's a very divisive character, as is Jeremy Corbyn. You know, we are, let's be fair, we're lacking very strong moral leadership, I think, in politics at the moment.
Can I come to you, Mary Cross? You've been around diplomatic tables all your life. How do you get people in the kind of heat of battle? And God, there was so much anger displayed last week. No pretend anger, real anger. How do you get people to cool down and to take the kind of advice that Kim Ledbetter might give? She speaks from some authority.
Yes, and she speaks in such a dignified way. It's really astonishing. Yes, in discussions and over meetings and over the years, there have been emotions displayed, and particularly where national interests are involved and people fear they're not winning and they're losing. What is generally done then is that you take a break, and then you have a discussion to try and tease out the various issues with the people involved, and you come back. And generally things have calmed down. But the way of doing it is to have discussions about what are the issues that are important to people, where you can find consensus, because
you'd need a good searchlight at the moment.
Yes, but that is the only way through. You know, there is no other way except try to break it down, see what are the important issues, where you can go with them, because there's no point in being stuck in a deadlock. You just have to move it forward. And, you know, that's something that actually the EU, which operates mainly on consensus, is very good at doing.
Yeah.
But take a break, talk to the people, get back again.
John?
Well, the problem, I think, is that brilliant people like Mary and her colleagues and people in the House of Commons are playing by conventional rules. Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings have entered this new world where they've torn up the rule book. It's the Steve Bannon playbook from the United States. And I think they have deliberately injected this incendiary rhetoric, repeating these terms over and over again, like the surrender bill. And that isn't the half of it. We had one Brexit advocate on Friday on BBC openly calling for rioting if Brexit isn't delivered by the 31st of October. Nigel Farage on Friday night at a Brexit party meeting said we should take a knife to the pen pushers, by which he means the civil servants. I mean, this is so incendiary and it is escalating, and I suspect it's going to get worse before it gets better. And my heart goes out to Jo Cox's family. I met her a couple of times when she worked for Oxfam. She was an extraordinary young woman, but I really fear that not only MPs could be killed in the weeks ahead, but we could be seeing large-scale rioting that we haven't seen in the UK in the modern era.
But, you know, people are picking out, well, obviously Cummings stands out. It's from all sides. I was watching Questions and Answers on the BBC the other night, and there was a Labour man in the audience, and he looked like he was about to have cardiac arrest. He was so angry, like he was bordering on incoherence, and he said, I voted to leave. Ginny Miller was on, you blocked me. That was democracy. But, I mean, so it's not just one side, a one-sided event, yes?
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. But if you look at, if Boris Johnson and the Brexiteers continue with this narrative that, for example, the UK is a supplicant member state that was forced to join the EU, that has not enjoyed, being the leader of the single market for, since the 90s, that had last year the best commission portfolio they could have been given, which was to protect capital markets union, that they've had a really enjoyable time over the past 40 years as members, as leading members of the European Union. Instead, they have this narrative that they were basically forced to stay in there, that the EU owes them something, that this Benn Act is a surrender bill.
But,
in actual fact,
but the people voted.
The people voted
to leave.
Absolutely, but they
and
didn't. But
you may not agree with it.
No, it's not that
it may not be in Ireland's interest.
But it's not
they
that
did
I don't.
Vote.
It's not that I don't agree with one. I don't have a problem with it per se. What I have a problem with is the fact that they had obligations in that leaving that weren't explained to people. When it comes to, for example, the Good Friday Agreement, and also when you look at the referendum results, 52-48, generally speaking, you might interpret that by saying that they want to stay relatively close to the European Union. What is being put on the table about getting Brexit done and clean break, that's nonsense. I mean, that's just insane. So the fact that we have to then, kowtow to this mentality when you look at the Operation Yellow Hammer. And the impact that that's going to have on the UK, and people just willfully ignoring that because they were told 3.5 years ago they could have this unicorn led Brexit. None of it makes sense. So the narrative is just incorrect.
Okay, Ronan?
Well, I think if you want to have the kind of back and forth and compromise that Mary was talking about, what you need are institutions, and you're shaping up for a people versus parliament election. And the problem with, I think, very movingly and touchingly, was Ledbetter there, was talking about that both sides have been fueling this. But this is about referendum democracy. This unleashes a binary choice. It means it sidelines issues around discussion and it sidelines even parties. So the parties have been sidelined. They've been taken over by Brexit. Parliament has been sidelined. And there is no way when it turns into a leave-remain binary choice, there's very few ways to have those back-and-forth discussions and to channel our differences.
This is true. But, I mean, from our own experience, and, I mean, some of our experience is, not that admirable. We voted no twice and we were told go back and get it right. So we're not saints when it comes to respecting results in that way. But I put it to you that the various things we have voted on to do with the European Union, I doubt if more than a couple of dozen Irish people, no more than British people on this one, actually read the treaties, went in, analysed it, reflected on it. I mean,
we have an awful lot of commentary in this country that is now looking at a virtuous Ireland, awful Britain. We are so much better. There, they've gone backwards, we're going forwards. And I don't think that's true. Look, I remember the Lisbon Treaty referendum in 2008, and I remember the posters that said Ireland will be in NATO, there'll be abortion, there'll be a 50-cent minimum wage. we seem to love referendums in this country, but actually
but we
it's more
always
by luck that we've
things.
Got on good. Yeah, mm. we've got out of it.
Mm.
I think Ireland would be a big mistake if we think that the pathologies that brought about Brexit are only present in Britain.
No, I think you're dead right. Yeah, I think people were concerned about conscription in the first Lisbon Treaty. I know people personally have voted against it for that reason, and again, abortion. So it can easily happen in any country. I think even Emmanuel Macron said it would happen.
So in other words, we shouldn't adjust our halo.
No, Macron himself said that it could happen in France.
Nice and Lisbon, second time round, the government understood that everybody had been so complacent. And those two successor campaigns were entirely different. And if you look at the data, people tell you they felt much more informed, much more confident about what they were voting on. And also they were voting on things that were substantively different. So the government had gone to the EU
well,
and
they
said,
weren't
we need
substantively
different.
Different.
Well, they were. For example, in 2008, there was a proposal that would have seen the European Commission reduced in size so that we wouldn't have a commissioner once in 5 years. It was because of the Irish diplomacy and intervention that changed. And by the way, we're now headed for a commission with Phil Hogan as the most senior commissioner in the trade portfolio. And that's partly because of the diplomacy and intervention that took place in 2008.
The other two referenda, of course, were different in the sense that if we hadn't passed them, we would have held up the whole of the European Union, whereas whatever regret you might have at Britain leaving, the EU will continue on. But I think one of the things that this has really shown, firstly, there's been a positive in that Irish people know very well a huge amount about the EU at this stage, and that is a positive and reflected in the figure. But I think, Marion, what is shown by this is the lack of trust in politicians to represent the interest of the country in an institution that they have been members of for the last 40 years. There is no way that you can explain the incredible intricacies of membership of the European Union. But you have to trust that your interests will be represented by the people you elect. And to say that take back control, I mean, the member states have total control over
but
the European Commission.
But the citizens don't seem to feel that. Now, I know feel is a very ephemeral word, but, I mean, people voted in Britain for a good reason.
But on the basis of a completely false prospectus and all kinds of criminal activity.
There's no point in denying that right across Europe, with the growth of the right in particular, that there is a big suspicion about Europe Europe, like Brussels, dictates.
Yeah, but that's entirely erroneous and it's actually not backed up by data. In Ireland, for example, the latest Red Sea poll in April, which is conducted every year, shows about 90% of people support membership. And if you look at the European Parliament election results, go back to the early part of the year, there was a lot of fear about a resurgence of the far right and that would really matter
in
the
Parliament.
Do you
think that's gone away?
It hasn't gone away, but if you look at the results of the Parliament elections, many of those far-right parties actually didn't do very well. They actually regressed.
Let me go back to Kim, if I may, because we've drifted on to Irish matters now, but it shows how all countries have their varying debates on these matters. I mean, you've made very clear where you're coming from. But as you watched the week, and presumably you will be watching the Tory conference and whatever happens next week, how do you think this has affected Britain internationally?
Oh, I think it's had a really unfortunate negative effect on how people will perceive Great Britain. I think it's had an unfortunate effect on how, on the country as a whole. And I think there's going to be an awful lot that needs to be done to rebuild our country. And that's why I'm saying that has to start from now. It has to start from everybody taking this step back and looking at how they behave from this point going forward. What I'm really clear about is I don't want Joe's name to ever be used to silence robust, passionate debate, because we're very fortunate that we live in a democracy where we have that freedom. And what's going on in your studio this morning is an example of that, and that's wonderful to see. People have got different opinions. We can thrash it out. We can talk about it. And that is what Joe would want, and that is what we want. Nor do I want, however, Joe's name to be used to score political points, because that is also not helpful. We must never forget that Joe was murdered. you know, 5 minutes from where I live in the street. She was shot and stabbed to death. She was a serving politician. We don't want any other family to have to go through what we've been through and what we continue to go through.
Right.
But that's a very fine balance to get those two things, isn't it? That we have to remember that. We have to make sure it doesn't happen again. But we also have to have these robust debates and discussions. And we need to be really clear that, that there is genuine fear amongst our politicians at the moment. They are facing a huge amount of abuse. They are facing threats to their staff, to their families. You know, and because of that, that is their reality.
Yeah.
So we've all got this responsibility to have these passionate discussions, have these important debates, but to do it in a civilised, respectful manner.
Okay. Okay, Kim Ledbetter. By the way, how are her children?
They're doing really well. They're doing really well. I mean, they're very tough little cookies. They're very much like Joe. Okay. they're doing really well. But a week like this week rocks us. It's really rocked my parents this week, I have to be honest. They found it extremely upsetting. But, you know, we're a strong family. We pull together. We've got each other. And we've got a very good network of friends and people who've looked after us for 3 years.
Okay. Kim Ledbetter, thank you very, very much indeed for talking to us. And we'll take a break.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Tesco Club Card, helping you save more every time you shop. Tesco, every little helps.
Welcome back to the programme. And we'll go on to domestic politics now, which includes thousands deserting Fine Gael, according to the Sunday Independent, page 4. A court ruling doesn't change Brexit Sunday Business Post. Increasing basic social welfare rates, Willie O'Dea in the Sunday Indo. And there's a great headline in the Sunday Indo over Colin McCarthy's article, which says Varadkar bans drilling for oil never found, which I thought was a very good headline. But also included in that, we might start there, the Sunday Business Post, page 2. Harris faces grilling over claims of fresh hike in children's hospital cost. Paul.
Well, at some point, the Irish government's actually got a free ride, in my view, for the last 18 months, 2 years, because of Brexit. So we haven't really been examining their domestic record so much, because they actually have been performing very, very well. I think we'd all agree Simon Coveney's done an excellent job to do with Brexit. But unfortunately, you know, the country is still being run extremely badly. And for an example, take the HSE. We're overspending there like we do every single year. And so when we're coming up to the budget now, everybody's talking about, oh, well, is there going to be tax cuts and whatever. Now, obviously, Pascal, he's got a very big excuse now not to do anything. So we would expect a very cautious budget. But I really think our politicians have been given a free ride here about what exactly are they doing in between the soundbites about Brexit.
Do you have confidence in the way, like, we all want the best possible treatment for all of our citizens should they become ill, or, you know, all of the other things the HSE does. But I mean, again, in the Colin McCarthy article, I think it was, he was talking about 5.4 billion, which in my lights is a certain amount of money, you know. And he said it kind of wouldn't run the health services up to Christmas, I think he said. And no one shouldn't laugh, because this is serious stuff.
Yeah, but again, it's the same. Basically, we continue to do the same things extremely badly. So, you know, there's calls for, oh, well, we need more money. I wouldn't give the HSE any more money whatsoever until we deep dive into exactly where the money is spent. And I think all this should be published so people, journalists, can go through it. It's all secretive about exactly where the spending is going. But, you know, it's like everything in Ireland, you know, so it's the same as building the airport. It's the same as when we overspend everything, which is, they're pretty good, so let's forget about the money. Now, unfortunately for us, you know, as I was saying, is we're still borrowing money, you know, so we now obviously we're borrowing money at negative interest rates, which is pretty good. But in general, you would expect a country.
We owe a lot of money.
You would expect a country like ours to actually be paying back some money at the moment because we're doing so well. Because, you know, rainy days are going to come. I would suggest the global economy is slowing down very, very rapidly. I said in this studio maybe 6 or 8 months ago that I'd expect Germany to have a recession. It now looks like they're going to go into a recession in the next month or so, an official recession. So these are things that are on the horizon for Ireland. But of course, all the the dialogue is about Brexit. And I really think Fine Gael are getting an absolute free pass forth on their domestic issues. And I mean, the housing crisis is another one. It is just utterly ridiculous. People are still going on that it's a subject of supply and demand.
Yeah.
Okay, it is not just a subject of supply and demand. It's the absolutely shambolic way we have dealt with the housing issue since 2008. We didn't have to let cuckoo funds into the country. We didn't have to give them tax breaks. We didn't have to let hedge funds go in and buy up massive amounts of property and now rent it out at extortionate prices to young people. We had choices to do it a different way and we choose not to do it. And we are exactly back where we were because we think exactly the same way. And again, you know, the housing crisis is a very interesting thing because it doesn't affect Fine Gael because their voters love house prices going up. You know, it's one of the...
Unless they're in their 30s and trying to buy a house.
But again, that's not what they're targeting. They're targeting older people who are comfortable with the house prices going up. So for them, having a housing crisis is not a problem. I know the rhetoric, they say different things. But for Fine Gael, it's for Michael Noonan, it was part of the strategy of getting the banks back in order.
And to get a baseline.
And to get a baseline and push house prices up. So there's no point in coming back and saying, oh, now we've got a housing crisis, how are we going to solve it? I mean, and this idea of having funds coming in here and giving them tax breaks to buy up huge amounts of property. You know, we've got Canadian pension funds that are now making unbelievable amounts of money out of the Irish property market while Irish people can't get a house. It's disgraceful in my book. And I think Fine Gael have been given a free ride on it.
Yeah, I think when you look at the page 4 of the Sunday Independent, Hugh O'Connell's piece saying that 6,000 people have abandoned Fine Gael in the last few years. But most of those people have been in rural areas, reflecting maybe the rural broadband scheme, which was obviously a bit of a disaster. And then also the rising cost of the National Children's Hospital, which is going to come to about 2 billion. But again,
hello. That article in the Business Post says that we could be going further.
Oh, further? Okay, yeah. Okay, well, but let's say 2 billion is bad enough anyway, right? When you consider what it was projected to be in the early days, 440 million. But obviously, it does corroborate exactly what you were saying there, Paul, because it's more in rural areas that Fine Gael is losing its support in parts of Cork and everywhere else, rather than, I suppose, its more affluent voters in parts of Dublin. And when you look at the housing crisis, most people who are suffering from that would not be Fine Gael voters in the first place.
How do we know that?
Well, it might be an interpretation, but I guess if you look at maybe that they have much more middle class voters, that they would not be necessarily as affected by the housing crisis.
Ronan?
Well, that article in the Irish Independent says there are 19,000 members in Fine Gael, the ruling party. And there was an Irish political scientist who died a few years ago, Peter Mayer, and his last book was called Ruling the Void. And it was about the decline of political parties across the Western world, that there used to be really broadly based memberships, big institutions. And look at the same in Britain, there's 160,000 Conservative Party members. And the problem is, in Ireland and in Britain now, we give the party memberships the right to elect the leadership, and they're very unrepresentative. Very unrepresentative, detached from society, it actually sidelines institutions again. We actually need political parties to run the democratic system, because otherwise, as Peter Mayer's research showed, voters just swing between parties. Voters think of themselves as consumers who are always right, not citizens who have the duty to inform themselves. And you hear it in the news. I was lied to, say, voters by Paul. And of course, but if voters rewarded politicians who told the truth, they tell the truth all the time. Voters reward politicians who lie. Voters treat themselves like consumers who are right. And they're furious that they take decisions that they when then say, oh, I didn't know it meant that in Brexit. Yeah. But we need parties for that.
Yeah, I remember before Corbyn was elected, they changed the system of electing within the Labour Party in Britain. And anyone with £3 could go in and get membership. It was alleged that members of the Conservative Party were going into it. But you would say that's nonsense. It should be the elected representatives that choose. Yeah,
Britain is a parliamentary system. And look, for centuries, they thought democracy is unsustainable. And it only became sustainable with institutions, parliaments, parties, broader civil society institutions.
But boring old work. Stuff
yeah,
that you can depend on.
The average voter doesn't have time to bring themselves up to date on the minutiae. They need to be guided by trade unions, parties, things. And sure, they should make their own decisions, but that's not going to be enough. And if you give people direct votes in referendums or hand it over to very unrepresentative party memberships, we're going to be in trouble.
John?
Oh, I broadly agree with Ronan, but We should remember that last time out, Fine Gael actually chose a new model where was partly the party membership and partly the parliamentary party. Yeah. And the parliamentary membership, about 70% voted for Simon Coveney, and they ended up with Leo Varadkar. But in terms of the budget, I think it's almost...
But according to Ronan's point, that's the way it should be, in that... You know, that if you elect a representative, then that's it. That's you've elected the representative and the representative engages.
Yeah, I'm an exponent of the indirect model where if people vote in an election, they're essentially giving powers to somebody to represent them, whatever that context is and wherever the parliament may be, at local level or at national level. Mm. But going back to the budget, I think it's a really interesting debate between the balance between tax and spending. There always is, in a sense.
Yeah.
I think Pascal Dunne has been given some cover this time around because of Brexit.
Which is Paul's point.
Yeah, his instincts are prudent. But there does seem to be an interesting divide between the Taoiseach and the Minister for Finance. The Taoiseach seems to want tax cuts. I think that's entirely wrong. I think we ended up, by accident, because of austerity, with a tax system that is more or less progressive, where people like me pay more than we did previously. I think we could actually pay more again. And the priority
I don't think you're running for election anytime soon.
I'm not anytime soon. I can rule that out emphatically. But the real problem we have is we've inherited all these infrastructural deficits, whether it's healthcare or housing or other things, and it's going to take a long time before we actually catch up.
Yeah, but we can say everything, blame everything on the crash, and we can blame everything on what went before the crash. But it is 10 years on. And I mean, you have to take on board with policy things that Brexit is giving amazing political cover.
Yeah, it is 10 years on. That's absolutely true. But we also have a growing population, one of the highest growth rates in population in Europe. And that's putting pressure in all kinds of way on schooling, on childcare and all kinds of other things.
OK, Brie?
Just a couple of points, mainly on the budget in general, but a point on the health services. We are only 4.8 million people, and I think the difficulties with the health service predated the crash. I mean, it does beg a belief that we can't organise a health system with the huge amount of money for 4.8 million people.
As one spokesperson comes in here sometimes, well, he's not a spokesperson, but he's in that world, he says it's kind of the size of Manchester. You know?
Yes.
Do you know, we can't organise it. But anyway, sorry, I beg
and
your pardon.
The article you quoted about the excuse me, the hospital today, I just took a sentence from that, which really is sort of hard to believe. The original budget estimate should have been more reflective of the complexity and scale of the project. I think that is really with all of the people involved that could not have been right. Oh. On the budget overall, I think there is a difficulty, as Paul said. We have a very high national debt. I find that quite worrying. It's the second highest, I think, in the EU. And the percentage of gross domestic product, and we pay 10 billion a year in debt. In debt interest. So the government is quite squeezed with a debt that size, trying to prepare for Brexit with a growing health budget. And what way to go in between those with the downturn in the international economy?
I think that the cost of the Children's Hospital will really bring people out in a rash. I think they've come so used to the HSE going over budget every year that they're like a whipped child and just accept it. Can I come back to you on this because you're a former civil servant? I missed something there. I mean, it's easy to blame Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Labour Party, left, right, whoever. But there is the permanent government, and these patterns run through the permanent government, right through, it seems, all politicians. Because you're guarded by secrecy, what responsibility do you think, or is it possible even, that the permanent government should take for this?
But the permanent government, I don't want to start off with but, because that gives the impression that there's some disagreement here. The permanent government draws up proposals, Marion, and they present them to the political level. And there's no kind of wool over the eyes in this, because what they present is options. And it's a political the politicians make policy. Civil servants don't make policy. They give options.
Did you ever see Yes Minister?
I did, yes.
Did you find any element of truth in that?
There was an element in it, but I
have never met a politician who didn't think there was an enormous element of truth in it. I think it should be taught at school.
Yes, but it was an over-exaggeration, because any politician will say, looking at some choices given to him, well, no, isn't there some better way of doing this? Or what are the other options? You know, you can't get away from responsibility, I think, that easily as a politician, because, as I say, civil servants don't make policy. Politicians make policy.
Well, speaking to civil servants, as they look at which politicians they're going to get, off the record, they will say words to the effect of, oh my God, and other likely things. And they will talk about how they're not going to allow this clown mess up the country, so to speak. And I believe that they tried to do that. Anyway, you're off the hook now, because I'm past 12 and we have to go to the newsroom. And in the newsroom, Ciarán Evren. Welcome back to the programme. Now, just before we go on, there are a couple of texts that I'd like to come to. One is, I was in a southern England small town a few weeks ago, says the texter. A small group of people had gathered in the square with placards saying that the closing of Parliament was wrong and undemocratic. Suddenly, a group of people came along and started to shout and point at them, calling them traitors and fascists, which you kind of couldn't have imagined in Britain some years ago. Another one says, overturning a public vote by any means has led the UK to chaos. Things are getting close to a tipping point, because it must be admitted that if Remain had won by the Brexit vote margin, we've never have heard about Brexit again, which is possibly 100% true. Another one up here says, you need to realise that the fault lines have changed. Left and right no longer mean anything. Another person says, I'm a middle-aged parent of three adult children. I vote for Fine Gael as my preferred political party. We live in a good house in a good area, but we're delighted to see house prices falling, as it is so helpful to all young people who want to purchase a home, and much more besides. Oh, there's one in on Sir Humphrey. I better read that, because I'm very partial to him. Civil servants don't make policy, Marion, as Sir Humphrey would say. They guide ministers to the right decision. That's right, I got it wrong. They guide ministers to the right decision. Now, let me go to another woman who knows a thing or two about guiding people to decisions. Marion McKeown, US correspondent for the Sunday Business Post. Now, in the US, the Democrats have launched an impeachment inquiry against President Donald Trump following the release of a transcript. Well, it wasn't a full transcript of a conversation between the US leader and the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky. The transcript appears to show President Trump using promised aid, I think it was about $400 million, to the Ukraine as a bargaining tool for an investigation into political rival Joe Biden and his son. Now, as I say, I'm joined by the US correspondent for the Business Post, Marion McKeown. Good morning to you, Marion. Listen, when I heard of this at first, I thought to myself that this is the Democrats identifying themselves again as hating Trump, with not an awful lot else going for them. But my advisors in the United States on this said, no, this is serious.
Yeah, I think, Marion, that this is, you know, in some ways, I think the Democrats have totally mishandled the whole Mueller inquiry. I think they totally mishandled the half dozen different investigations that have been going on since, which Trump has totally stonewalled. And they've really proven how ineffectual and hand-wringing they can be. Because when Republicans fight, they fight tough. And Democrats don't just turn up with a knife to a gunfight, they turn up with a flower. You know, they're just not good fighters in the way that Republicans are. But this is, I think, different. And I think there is a little bit of a tide turning with this. The reasons being... Well, let's get into this first of all. To sum it up, and there's a cast of characters in this, you could not make it up. I mean, I think it was Martin McDonagh who said in one of his plays, worser and worser this story gets, and nothing is more true than about the Trump administration. Briefly, what happened was Ukraine elected a new president, Vladimir Zelensky, as he said, in April this year. There were parliamentary elections in July, which he also won. Donald Trump phoned him on July 25th for the sort of standard congratulatory how are you getting on call. And normally the Ukraine, putting this in context, the Ukraine is in a terribly vulnerable position, and was, because it had already been invaded by Russia and Crimea, etc. Along then comes Donald Trump, who becomes the president of America, who says, well, should we be helping the Ukraine at all? Why should we care if Russia, you know, invades them? And then is shown to be a very sort of big admirer of Putin. So this all makes the Ukraine feel very, very vulnerable, because Russia could be emboldened and decide to invade again any day. So they want to keep on the right side of the American president. So already Trump is holding a big stick without having to do anything. Now, because America and the Republicans in particular really did see the value of supporting the Ukraine, they had authorized a $391 million aid package, which included military aid. It was basically a done deal, and it was to be delivered to them. They were seen as a very valuable American ally that was in a very, very vulnerable position vis-a-vis Russia. So Trump gets on the phone, and a couple of days beforehand, he has frozen this aid package. He then speaks with Zelensky, and the rough transcript of the call basically says that he wants a favour. He wants a favour from Zelensky, and he refers to this crazy conspiracy theory about the Democrats and the whole hacking thing really starting in the Ukraine. He wants that looked into, but also he wants to reopen investigations into Joe Biden and his son Hunter Biden, because Hunter Biden was on the board of an energy company called Burisma, which was owned by a former Ukrainian politician, and it had been investigated for corruption by a previous prosecutor in Ukraine. He was fired. Joe Biden was amongst many people who had pressured for him to be fired, but not because he wasn't investigating Burisma, which was regarded as being potentially corrupt, but because he wasn't going far enough in the investigation. So Biden and the US ambassador at the time and the EU and a lot of other people all said, this guy, Viktor Shulkin, is useless. He's not being serious about investigating corruption. Now, Shulkin was appointed by, I should say, and I'm sorry, this is so much detail. Peter Poroshenko, who was appointed after the previous pro-Russian president was ousted. Anyway, Shokin is then pushed out and he's replaced with a new investigator called Yuri Lutsenko. And Trump is now urging Zelensky to reopen this investigation, and the reason why is not entirely clear, other than that if an investigation were opened into Joe Biden and his son at this point, it would certainly in July, it would seriously damage Joe Biden's election chances, Trump believes, and Trump believes Joe Biden is the only Democrat who can beat him. So basically he has Zelensky really over a barrel, where he's saying, I want a favour from you, and it's kind
and it's
of
clear going to cost you $400 million.
Yeah, that if he doesn't get this favour, and it's not just the $400 billion, it's the prospect that the US will withdraw support from the Ukraine and leave them to fend for themselves against Russia. So there's a lot of pressure on Zelensky.
But the thing about it, I've been hearing people saying, you know, that this is simple. And, you know, because this is simple, it's easy to explain. If you look at Trump's base, I can see their eyes glazing over and think, here we go again. They're attacking our guy.
Yeah, And that will absolutely happen. Nancy Pelosi was very, very... She's the Democratic Speaker of the House and the Speaker in the House of Representatives. She was very reluctant to go after impeachment, even when Robert Mueller found that there were possibly 10 instances of obstruction of justice to do with the whole Russian inquiry. She said, no, 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 people are sick of it. They don't understand it. It'll just turn them off. This is, although the background is complex, it's arguably simpler. Did the American president basically shake down, as Nancy Pelosi put it, the newly elected president of the Ukraine to force him to investigate a political rival, somebody who he thought could beat him in a presidential election. And that's really what it comes down to. And the second part, which is equally critical, is was there then a cover-up? And this seems to be, certainly there is evidence of this, because the normal place where these calls are kept, this call was removed from by White House officials, and it was put into a very, very secret server. You know, we hear about these servers all the time, which is normally reserved and with a code word. And in this situation, I've spoken with intelligence people. They say, look, this is the kind of place where if you're plotting a huge operation, like possibly a war, a lot of people have used the attack against Bin Laden, the operation to take him out as an example. This is the sort of level of top secret where this phone call was stashed, where the digitized readout of it was stashed. It was basically put into a concrete barrel and dumped in the bottom of the sea. So this seems on its face to be very clear evidence that the White House didn't want anyone to know about this call. But of course things get out and people were so alarmed that they spoke about it and White House officials discussed it. And this whistleblower, who apparently is a CIA analyst, a career CIA person, was really concerned, as a lot of people in America are, about the way in which the current administration is just riding roughshod over any kind of political norms, over all the rules, over everything
we're
to do what they want.
We're back to institutions,
so,
really, like we were talking about
back
in Britain.
To institutions. And, you know, I think that at the moment, one barometer, which is, I'm not a big fan of polls, but this is quite interesting. Back in July, around July, before any of this came out, and when the Mueller report came out, only about 29% of people supported impeaching Trump. Now, at the moment, it's evenly split. Polls are showing that slightly more Americans now favour impeachment than not, by maybe 1 or 2%. Now, this could go down or go up again, depending on how Democrats handle the next phase, which is the articles of impeachment. But I do want to say, Marion, that even if, and this is where it could get a little bit crazy, even if the Democrats and the House votes on the articles of impeachment and they're presented to the Senate under Mitch McConnell could decide, oh, we're not holding a trial, we're not going to do anything.
Yep.
And if they decide that, there is no remedy.
Okay. Paul, do you keep an eye on these things?
Oh, well, absolutely, I keep an eye on it. Well, the first thing is the financial markets didn't take any of this seriously whatsoever. The share prices didn't fall. The dollar is as strong as the strongest it's been for 2 years. So they're not taking so far the impeachment bit. I would say it is pretty simple. Donald Trump looks like he's broken the law, but unfortunately, the chances of it being proved between now and the election in 2020 are very, very slim. So the first thing you think is, well, his base is going to be exercised by this, so he's more likely to do better in a 2020 election than he would do anyway. More tellingly, it's sort of an aside point, but it's something I follow quite a bit, is they're looking into his tax receipts, the Democrats as well.
Yeah, well, how's that progressing?
Well, it's progressing slowly, but I think it's absolutely fascinating because they've subpoenaed maybe about 20 banks. Deutsche Bank is his main lender, and they've subpoenaed Deutsche Bank and the records, and Deutsche Bank has said they're going to give over the records. Deutsche Bank has its own problems. It's down 90% share price.
That's
mainly
a problem,
gone bust itself. But I would suggest that going that way, they might have more success, because I would suggest if his tax books are ever released, you know, he's a goner. So I would suggest...
You only suspect that.
No, that's what I suspect, yeah. So I would suggest that the financial markets would take that a bit more serious than the impeachment. It's not that they're not taking it seriously. It's going to be a long, drawn-out process, and no one can really see where it's going, and it's probably going to take years. So, again, for me in the financial markets, there's a lot more things to worry about than Donald Trump's impeachment.
Okay. John?
Can I just say on that, Paul, that I think you're right, Trump's tax records will will be a big thing if they eventually come out. But Americans are expecting that. They also, at this stage, almost expect him to break the law. The impeachment process will probably take about 4 months, which means that if there is a trial, if the Senate doesn't decide to just delay it or kick it into touch after 2020, it built into the impeachment process took the whole thing beginning to end less than 4 months. That's, you know, so if you're looking at that, you're talking about possibly January. The Democrats are moving full speed ahead with this. They're taking a deposition from Kurt Volker, the US envoy, who quit there on Thursday. Also, you've got to figure that it's also come out now in the meantime that Donald Trump told the Russian ambassador and the Russian foreign minister during that bizarre meeting he had with them back in 2018 that he wasn't worried about the Russian meddling in the US elections. There, things do reach a critical mass where if I suspect that the Democrats' purpose of impeachment is that it gives them serious powers to access, it gives them much stronger powers of subpoena than they have at the moment for all these piddling little right. Senate investigations,
okay.
or beg your pardon, the House investigations,
yeah.
and that they think that the public, when if all this stuff comes out, the public might be sufficiently revulsed that even if the Democrats, it's unlikely he'll be impeached anyway. It would take 20 Republican senators to cross the
highly
aisle
unlikely,
for
yeah.
Trump to be impeached. That ain't going to happen.
Okay, John,
but,
you wanted to come
again,
in there.
Sorry, I beg your pardon. Okay.
Sorry, I'll come back to you, Marion. Yeah?
Good morning, Marion, and thanks for your analysis. Rigorous as always. I agree with you. The Democrats really didn't handle the Mueller investigation very well. We shouldn't forget, though, that quite a number of Trump's acolytes went to prison, in particular Paul Manafort, who was his campaign manager at one point and was up to his neck in illegal activity in Ukraine. But I think this is also very dangerous for the Democrats because, you know, Trump is doing this stuff in plain sight. Rudy Giuliani, his lawyer fixer, goes on television and his usual strategy is to first deny that they've done these things, then he admits it, and then he kind of says, okay, so what? And they've done
this
very consistently.
That works.
Yeah, it is. And I think the danger for the Democrats is that this is about the front runner in the Democratic primaries, Joe Biden. And I think inevitably he's going to be damaged by this. I think his campaign was actually in trouble anyway, even as the front runner. But there's a big question mark. What on earth is Hunter Biden, his son, doing in Ukraine, getting $50,000 a month from a Ukrainian company? Ukraine is one of the worst countries in the world for corruption measured by Transparency International, the big organization that does this. And in particular, the gas industry is just a cesspit of individuals and oligarchs that are essentially engaged in theft, whole-scale theft. Yanukovych, the previous president of Ukraine, was run out of town.
I think we might say the whole gas industry.
I would say emphatically the entire gas industry
in
Ukraine.
In Ukraine?
Yes.
Oh, well, I don't know if they're listening in Ukraine, but they might
I'm
hear
I'm sure you have
it.
Some fans in Kiev. You've got to have.
Well, I mean, the oligarchs and the gas and the oil and all that are so
it hasn't changed at all. Yeah. Ukraine has had three revolutions since 1990 after Yanukovych. Poroshenko himself, the president, was an oligarch, and he's been replaced by a very inexperienced guy, Zelensky, mid-40s. He was an actor. He won an emphatic mandate from the people, but there are deep question marks about him and his links to very shady operations.
Okay, Ken.
Absolutely. On the Biden thing, I couldn't agree with you more on Hunter Biden. And, you know, it's something I was talking to a Biden campaign aide a while ago, and my understanding is this, that Hunter Biden is a deeply troubled individual. It's public knowledge that he has struggled with drug abuse, with alcohol abuse. His marriage collapsed after, and the divorce was very, very acrimonious. He's had a lot of problems. He's also worked as a lobbyist. He has embarrassed his father. I definitely think the Bidens are a fiercely close family. I mean, fiercely close. And the agreement they apparently came to is that they just wouldn't talk business. Now, Joe Biden, who was in charge of dealing with Ukraine, he became Obama's point man on Ukraine. So for him to look the other way while his son was getting 50 grand a year, as you say, and this chap who owns Burisma, there was always questions about him, this oligarch, about how he got the licenses, how he got all that kind of thing. So, you know, Joe Biden apparently, and again, I was told this fairly confidentially, that the one thing that will make Joe Biden see red is if you question his son, Hunter. Now, you know the family background history. Hunter was in a very serious car accident when he was 20 months old. His mother and younger sister were killed. He got a serious head injury. His other brother was seriously injured as well, who died of brain cancer a couple of years ago. There was a lot of tragedy in the family. Maybe Joe Biden has a soft spot or a blind spot, I think people would say, but he absolutely should have said, get off that board. Get off that board. Even if you're not doing anything wrong, it looks wrong. And it was a huge mistake for Joe Biden to make. I'm surprised that the Obama administration didn't lean on Joe Biden to make him to insist on it.
Okay.
It was a big mistake.
Okay, just one last quick question. What about Elizabeth Warren?
You know, I don't know. I think that it's way too soon to call on anything.
Okay.
I think you're right about Biden. I don't think he's going to get the nomination with or without this happening. I think he's already on the skids.
Okay.
I mean, you know, watch this space, Marion. It's only going to get crazier from here on in.
Oh, but there's a lot of craziness going on in this neck of the woods as well.
At the moment.
There's plenty to go around. Listen, thank you very, very much indeed, Marion, for that. And before I go to the break, you were going to say?
Well, I was going to say, the Democrats have a dilemma, because if you tolerate outrageous behaviour repeatedly, then it becomes the new normal. And so you can see what to expect from a pig but a grunt, but then you end up tolerating it. So they do have to call a halt. But then the Clintons and the Obamas do bear an awful lot of responsibility. How are the Democrats relying on Joe Biden, who looked old in 2008, as their person? The Clintons and the Obamas didn't nurture any replacements. They didn't bring anybody up. Mm-hmm. The Democrat leadership team and the House of Representatives, their top three, are all over 78 years old. The Democrats
are being
have
ageist here?
Well,
I think so,
for someone who's 77.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a good point, though.
They have not brought anybody up, and therefore they've got this empty bench to face Trump, who is a nightmare but a talented campaigner.
Right, there you go. Last word, Shona.
Yeah, I just wonder if anything is going to turn people off Donald Trump. When you look at what he's doing in plain sight in relation to whether it's his taxes or, you know, this bribe or, you know, blackmail of the president of Ukraine, or most importantly, children in cages, and the fact that he's decided to change legislation in the Texan border to mean that children can be kept in cages indefinitely, which used to be, I think, a limit of up to 21 days. Several of those children have died, and none of that apparently seems to make any impact on whether people think he's a suitable president or a decent human, in fact.
Marion, can I make a very quick point
as
a last thing? Look, this is how it works in America. 30 to 36% of the electorate do not care what Donald Trump does. Every child from Mexico could die in a cage. They would still vote for him. I'm not being flippant here. I'm really not. But what the Democrats are hoping is that the other 14%, you know, the bit in the middle, the moderates, the Republicans who consider themselves old school Republicans, will eventually become sickened by all this. And also, Washington is a place where survival is the first rule of order of the day. Trump has no friends in Washington. He only has people whose interests coincide with his at the moment. And they would turn on him once it's no longer profitable to support him. So there's a lot of other stuff going on here. But they're the things. Trump's base, regardless of what he does, will vote for him. Republicans in Congress, not so much.
Right.
What will turn off people about Trump will be a slowdown in the American economy, and that is coming.
Right. Is it coming?
Yeah.
You say that very firmly.
Well, no, but the numbers are already, I mean, put it like this, sorry, the numbers that we look at to anticipate the bigger GDP numbers are already signifying that, so it's not my view.
How far away is that then, Paul?
Well,
that will have impacted the 2020 election.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's why they're trying to make so many tax cuts and more policies to be pro-economy and pro-big companies, because they're aiming for the 2020 election. For an example, the Federal Reserve last Christmas said they were going to put up interest rates three times in 2019 because the economy is doing so strongly. They've reversed that completely. They've already cut interest rates twice. They're going to cut interest rates.
Is that political pressure?
Oh, yeah. Trump is at war.
It's political pressure, but it's also because the economy is slowing, and they can see it. They're watching the same things as we are, which is it's slowing fairly dramatically around the world, as I say, in Europe and Japan, and America's going to be affected, and that's going to put people off Trump.
Okay, you were going to come in there.
Briefly,
I mean, diplomats don't use the word blackmail anyway, so we know that.
we might occasionally. Just to say, I would agree. I think the Democrats had no option at this stage, and it's probably not Trump. I think they're trying to set a benchmark for behaviour by a president, and if they were seen to let so many different things go.
Are you talking the difference between politics and ethics?
Yes.
Right.
I am. Okay. I think people aren't fools. They can see at some level you've reached the end. Right. Could I put in a short plea for the collateral damage in all of this of Ukraine? It's hard to overestimate what it's like for a country like Ukraine to get itself back into a democracy and run its systems of legal, etc. There are collateral damage in this, and there's a war going on.
Yeah.
And it's...
Yeah, I think that it's still on the Department of Foreign Affairs, don't travel. I think there's a no travel thing. It's certainly Crimea. Yeah.
It's don't travel to eastern Ukraine. Yeah.
The problem is the Donbass in the east of Ukraine, absolutely. Yeah. More than 10,000 people have died in that war. Mary's absolutely
you
right.
You lecture there, don't you?
I'm going there actually at the end of October to give some talks.
Oh, well,
there,
you can report back to us.
I shall.
Okay. Listen, on that note, thanks again, Marion, and we'll take a break.
Thank you.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Tesco, where even the little things make all the difference. Tesco, every little helps.
Welcome back to the programme, and we've been joined by Bill Hughes, TV producer and director, really in the context of what's going to be in our cinemas next week, but he's here as part of the group, so to speak, at the moment. Greta, I have to go to you on this. There was an article in a paper today, I haven't got the list in front of me, where it said, where it said that French intellectual, middle-aged men were criticising Greta because she wasn't like the sexy Swedish kids that they knew in their youth.
Yeah, I have to say that was, Marion, that was absolutely jaw-dropping. And I mean, you're quoting from some of the milder aspects of that article. And these were very well, very reputable French literary people. It's extraordinary, the invective that this girl who, you know, thought up a campaign because she was committed to it and went ahead and got a lot of adherence, and she's doing it as she sees right. But the invective that she has attracted in doing so is astonishing.
Why
but that,
I think,
was the worst I've seen.
Yeah. I mean, Justine McCarthy's writing really well about it today too. Why is she generating so much? I mean, is it just in plain sight, people don't want to hear what she's saying?
Partly, I think, because there is generally a mobilisation of younger people all around the world, and she's become the sort of symbol of that and the spokesperson. And her contribution to the UN on Monday was just riveting and extraordinary. The way she used language, the way she put leaders on the spot and said, you know, we are going to hold you to account. It was quite extraordinary. And the language that you're referring to, Bernard Pivot, who is 84 and the head of one of the French intellectual think tanks, he's reflective, I think, of a lot of older men who just can't believe that young people can have any agency in politics. I've heard again and again this week after Greta Thunberg's appearance at the UN.
Yeah.
Oh, somebody must be controlling her in the background. Who's pulling the strings? And the assumption that there are these dark forces behind her. They don't want to believe that a 16-year-old can think through the issues for himself or herself and can be such a powerful advocate for her generation and point out that their futures are being stolen away from them by people who have behaved recklessly when they've been in power, or, as she said in the UN, where they could have intervened at a much earlier point, they've chosen not to.
Kieran, you want to come in?
Well, I think people don't get angry when you tell them lies. They get really angry when you tell them things that they're true but they wish weren't true.
Yeah.
I think, however, though, movements need symbols, and this movement needs a young symbol because that generation is the one who will really suffer. But there is a problem. I mean, I would worry a little bit for her. I know that I remember an interview with the tennis player Chris Evert, who said that her psychology was really warped by becoming famous at the age of 16. Greta Thunberg, I think, is someone who is probably personally going to struggle with it. And I saw a really good article on during the week that compared her to the long tradition of Christian shepherd girl prophets, like the children at Fatima, or the, and that in a way her youthfulness
what she's
and her
saying
simplicity.
Is very true.
Well, I mean, her prophecy is backed by science, which is quite unusual in biblical
Paul, you
terms.
Want to come in?
I'm going to really alarm everyone here, but I would totally disagree with what everyone's saying so far. I am one of those middle-aged men, and Greta really has, I have a problem with what she's saying, not about her herself, and I understand that people, I think she's very brave, I think she's got tenacity to speak out. One of the main, you know, all the articles in the papers are all about Greta, how she looks and what people are saying about her, and I'm not interested in any of that. I'm interested in what she's actually saying. Now, what she's saying is we're all talking an economic fairy tale was one of her main. We need climate justice. These things are just misguided. For an example, 1.2 billion people have been taken out of poverty in the last 25 years in the world because of cheap fossil fuels. Now, obviously, we know climate change is serious. We know climate change is man-made and we know it exists. So I'm not a denier of any. But these messages that are coming across in sort of a hysterical manner, saying that, you know, scaring children that the world is going to end. I mean, I don't know if anyone saw the movie Annie Hall last night. It was on TV.
But he'd know.
Okay, but it starts with a great clip where the young Woody Allen says he's not doing his homework anymore. And why is he not doing his homework? Because the universe is expanding and it's going to blow up. So he says, well, I'm not going to bother. And then his mother says, you live in Brooklyn. Brooklyn isn't going to blow up. But the main point is, no one in any of these articles on Greta is actually describing what the climate justice movement are saying. I'll just give you some examples. So they're against carbon capture. This is one of the things that Bill Gates is looking into, and they're saying, no, we're against that because it's a false solution. They're against smart agriculture. That's astonishing. They're against smart agriculture. Think about that. So the messages that are coming across, and this is why middle-aged men who know anything about the subject matter are getting annoyed, because people are giving her free pass on her subject matter because she's 16 and because of everything else.
Yeah, now, but you saw that report that came out of the UN this week about the rise in maybe even a metre. Well, that's scary stuff.
Absolutely. Can I just bring you back to the discussion we had about the HSE, because the two things are related. So Germany has just announced that they're going to spend 40 billion euros in the next four years to stop carbon emissions. Okay, so the climate scientists say that in 100 years they will have lowered carbon emissions by 0.00018. Okay, that's what it will achieve, hopefully, in 100 years. Now, if you took that 40 billion and used it in a different manner, you could save 10 million people's lives that have tuberculosis in Africa at the moment. Now, what I'm saying is, I'm not against her and the message. What I'm saying is, we need to think smarter about how we use our resources and our money. So what I would suggest is going to happen is the same middlemen that make a fortune no matter what situation are going to take all this money that is government-led and whatever, climate scientists, you know, it's a huge industry now, and the results that Greta wants aren't going to be achieved, but the money will be lost.
Ronan, you want to come in?
We don't want Greta Thunberg to be doing detailed economic or scientific projects to specifically address climate change. What we want her for, and what she's doing, is to give voice to the message that we're not doing anything close to enough.
Yeah. Bill, do you take a view?
I take the view that what surprises me is that everybody's focusing on what Greta Thunberg said at the UN, and nobody's focusing on what Boris Johnson said at the UN, which is the most terrifying speech that has ever been delivered by anybody who wasn't an undergraduate of some overprivileged college. He spoke like a complete buffoon, an ass, and I'm sorry that poor Greta is being used as some kind of hijack when in fact the focus should be on the disgraceful behaviour of Boris.
Okay, we're going to be talking about your subject in a moment, but I'm afraid this is of national interest. Who was watching the football match yesterday, the rugby match?
I was.
Everybody was. Yeah, but Not me. I couldn't see it because I was...
I said during the week that we were so arrogant going into it, and we were talking about how many, you know, we were going to get the bonus point and how many tries were we going to score, and it was all this ridiculous overhype, over language about the Irish, give them an inch and they'll take the whole championship.
You want to come in there, John?
Well, one of the really depressing things about, if we just focus on Irish rugby and World Cups, is this level of expectation that attaches to them. And when we actually get there, we don't just underperform, we do so spectacularly. I can remember in France, for example, we played Argentina, which didn't have the profile that it does now in world rugby, 15 years ago or so, and the disappointment was absolutely acute. And I'd raise another issue, which is a wider one about Irish sport, and it is what happens to our people when they get to the very highest level. If we look at the Irish soccer team, the celebrated Charlton era, I don't think there was very much to celebrate in that. We didn't play very good football.
Sound like Eamon Dunphy now.
We reached the quarter final. Dunphy was a prophet in his time before he went wrong, as far as I can see. But it also applies to our top athletes and so many more. There is a real problem about underperformance at the very highest level. And too often, I think, we celebrate underachievement.
Have been pretty damn successful.
They have, but they have never done it in a World Cup, and that's what really matters.
Well, this is what they're trying to do this time. You're our expert on Japan. What were you doing there?
I worked there in the financial markets for 4.5 years. I was transferred there from the UK. Japan is a fascinating country. I'm delighted that they won. I think it's going to be great. It's actually really great for Irish business, because if we thrashed them, we wouldn't have been noticed. Now everybody in Japan is going to be talking about Ireland. Where the hell is Ireland? What is Ireland all about? They already like Ireland anyway, so I think it's going to be great for that. But I find it fascinating, because people ask me all the time, as the people keep saying on the Prophet of Doom about recessions and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So is where's the next financial crisis going to come? And I would always point out it's going to come in Japan. And you were quoting about it, you were talking about ageism earlier on, but I got some statistics about the Japanese economy. There's more adult nappies sold in Japan than there is baby nappies at the moment.
Thank you for that.
That's going to put you off your lunch. But the Japanese government is saying the population is going to fall by a third in the next 50 years. There's about 38% of the population in 2065 is going to be over 65. So 38%.
Wow. And
so their debt to GDP ratio at the moment is 240%. They've had negative interest rates for 20 years. Mm. It hasn't worked. Their stock market was 1989 when it hit its high, and then it fell 80%. It's recovered quite a bit. So if you're looking for sort of crisis material, the Japanese economy is where you need to look. Negative interest rates. And it's just very interesting, because everyone's cheering on Christine Lagarde coming into the ECB. Negative interest rates. And if you look at the experience of Japan with negative interest rates and zero, you know, and quantitative easing, it doesn't
work. Were in recession. They were zombied forever, weren't they?
It's a depression, and they're still in it. I mean, the growth is very, very low. You know, as I say, it's a fantastic place to visit, and I'm so glad that I lived there. I've got a lot of Japanese friends. Amazing place. Really, you know, safe, really friendly, very interesting. But as a it's a financial basket case.
Right. So, okay. Well, on that note, may I say that RT Radio 1, as part of Rugby World coverage, wants to send you and a friend, that's the listeners, sorry, not the panellists, excuse me, all the way to the final. So listen to this now for all the details on how you can win. Welcome back to the programme. Now, as I say, we were joined by Bill Hughes, and we're going to talk about a movie it's called a biopic, is that what you call it? Yeah. Judy, to hit our cinemas. And essentially it's about Judy Garland. And, you know, I suppose everybody in the audience, no matter what age they are, will know of Judy Garland.
They certainly will. And
old and young.
Yeah, they'll know Somewhere Over the Rainbow. They'll know Get Happy. They'll know some of the songs. And they'll have a hint of the tragedy and the story of her life, and that it didn't go exactly well. But people, you know, everybody sees The Wizard of Oz at Christmas, or It's a Wonderful Life. It's one of the staples, or Willy Wonka. That's what they see. And whether they take it in or not, it's on in the background. So they're aware there's a girl in a gingham dress with pigtails.
Looking very happy.
Yeah, being chased around by a wicked witch. You know, it's like that's just the normal. But
sounds like Greta Thunberg.
Yeah, sounds like, exactly. Well, that's I was going to make that comparison. You know, and nobody believed her. So the thing about this film is it's about the last 6 months of Judy's life, and it is tragic. She's played by Renee Zellweger. It has flashbacks to her earlier life. It does have the look of a lavish made-for-television film rather than a big blockbuster movie.
Yeah.
But it's made by, co-produced by BBC Films. And it's set in London when she was doing her final engagement, which was at the Talk of the Town. She was literally penniless. She was literally homeless. She was living on amphetamines. She had to come to London to raise some money to be able to finance that she would be able to get her children and have them live with her, Lorna and Joey, her two young children. Lisa Minnelli, her oldest daughter, had already left home at that stage and had gone on and starting to have a career. But it
seems that nearly structured into the system was that she was going to be, I don't mean abused in a sexual way, but exploited dreadfully.
It was horrendous. From the very start, her mother would feed her slimming tablets because she thought she looked too fat. She knew she had a voice. She wanted to sell her daughter's voice and so that they could all get some money out of it. But in order to do that, she wanted to keep her slim and young and beautiful because she knew that's what would work on camera. And so when she signed with MGM, she was only like 14. She got a deal. And Louis B. Mayer, the head of MGM, he's such a divisive character in the history of cinema because he treated everybody appallingly. He was an atrocious misogynist. He was an ogre in every way. But there's a scene where he comes down on the studio floor and stands on the yellow brick road of The Wizard of Oz and says to her, "You may be Judy to them, but to me you'll always be Frances Gum," which was her real name. "You'll be the little fat girl with the fat ankles from the country. Now take your pills, sing your songs, get up on time, and don't bother me again." And this is, you know, that's well documented that he did that kind of thing. But he didn't just do it to her. And that was the kind of studio system that Bette Davis later rebelled against and smashed. But it was bullies like that. Really savage. And also, he had somebody walk with her all the time to ensure she didn't eat. And they would send her on studio dates, makey up dates with Mickey Rooney and sort of look at Judy having it for the fan magazines. And they'd be at a table in a diner and they'd have food in front of them. And the poor girl would be wanting to just have a bite of the burger. And there was a woman that, "Do not touch the food," you know, and really scary. And at one stage, she breaks out and eats a single French fry. And the joy on her face at the taste of a French fry, but she knows she's going to pay for it later. So it's that kind of savage controlling of a young girl that there was no way that she was going to be a normal person.
Couldn't be.
Because they had, she would rest on the set of Wizard of Oz. She would rest in the little cabin. She'd have a little sleep. She'd wake up. And they'd have uppers laid out for her. She had to take the pills so that she'd perform. Then they'd have downers to send her to sleep.
Was there no law?
No, nothing. Nothing. And nobody protecting and no duty of care and no studio HR. Nobody looking after anybody. And so I've read a lot of the biographies of Judy and they would bring a tear from a stone, you know. But still, you're drawn to that voice. You're drawn to the magic of the power of the voice. It's a huge voice. And if only she had been properly treated. Mm. You know, she'd be 97 now, you know, and she probably could have lived to a ripe old age of 97, but she probably could have entertained us all through the 70s and 80s. But in the end, in the last few months of her life, she was singing in gay bars in New York for $100. That's all. Whereas 6 years before, she had packed out the Palace Theatre in Times Square for 19 weeks. It was a record-breaking run. It was produced by her then-husband, Sid Luft, and the money all miraculously disappeared. So she never got any of the money she earned. She was constantly broke, constantly penniless, and was a little girl lost in the world. And that's how she was right up to the end.
You so never think that when you're watching it on television, do you?
No. But you can actually track her decline in some senses by looking at her chat show appearances, which on YouTube now, the algorithms bring you from one to the other, and it is dreadful. But there was a brilliantly written piece yesterday in the Irish Times by Tara Brady, one of their film correspondents, about her importance to the gay community. It begins with "Over the Rainbow" and "The Rainbow Flag" and so on, but because her life was so tough, I think, and because she overcame so much evidence evidently, and of course because she almost became a martyr in the sense, she became a sort of patron saint, I think, for gay people, and her status is completely untouched, I think, in that regard.
And it's touched beautifully in this movie, where she has a relationship with two elderly gay men who come to the door of the Talk of the Town every night to just tell her how brilliant she was and how much it meant to them. And one night she comes out and she's just, it's raining and there are these two people and they're still there. And she says, and she says, can I take you for dinner? Because at the time she was having a good run, and they're like beside themselves, and then they can't find anywhere open. So they bring her back to their flat and they make scrambled egg. And she said it's the best scrambled egg she's ever had. And those kind of stories are in London. When I was, you know, coming into myself in the 70s in London, those were still relatively fresh stories. And a lot of the older gays would say, oh yeah, Judy came to our place that night and Judy was this and this. And you would know that she did gravitate towards vulnerable people.
Possibly because of her own vulnerability?
Well, also, yeah. And growing up in a house where her mother was a completely domineering person, her father, they had to keep moving house because her father kept being caught in bed with young men. And she had two sisters. So she grew up in a very dysfunctional home, and then her father died when she was 14. So he never got to see any of her fame or any of her excitement.
And he might have protected her.
He might have tried anyway, you know.
Yeah. Are you going?
Yes, I was just, it's interesting that they've made the film and made it so graphically, because in a sense it mirrors what's going on throughout the world and throughout the film scene at the moment, that what is coming up now, what is becoming known of all of the abuse of every form in the film industry, and of course it's not confined to the film industry,
indeed,
but there's a great openness now of all of the abuse of different sorts that particularly young people were subjected to in the decades, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, that were hidden completely. So if this film does anything, it will show, you know, what awful cruelty was meted out to young people.
On that issue of harassment, Tara Brady's piece shows that dreadfully, even during the filming of The Wizard of Oz, some of the munchkins, if you can believe it, would put their hands up her dress. And she was subject to harassment on an almost daily basis in the studio system.
Right.
When I was doing my PhD in London, Monica Lewinsky was in the NSE at the time I was there, and you could see she knew people were looking at her.
Of course.
She was trying to have a normal life. I remember the Students' Union magazine before she arrived said absolutely revolting things about cigars and that was 2006, 2007. It was considered funny at the time, and you see how it followed her throughout her whole life.
I have this theory that she was the one in the whole mess that behaved with some dignity. Didn't kiss and tell. She was terrorised by the authorities. She was lifted up and taken off in a way that was absolutely scandalous.
And she was 21. She wasn't married to anybody. Bill Clinton, got to tour the world getting applause and ovations, and her life was ruined. She was standing in front of me in a queue once, and I wanted to say basically what you just said to her, and I thought, I won't bother. She doesn't want to talk about it. And then I heard an interview later, she kind of probably would have liked it, I should have, but you can see it wrecked her life, and he swanned around the world getting applause for the next two decades.
Yeah. Okay, Bill.
Well, Liza Minnelli and Lorna Luft, her two daughters, have decided that they are not going to see the film, that they are not going to endorse the film, because they want to protect their mother's legacy. That, to me, on one hand, I can understand, but on the other hand, Lorna Luft tours the world singing duets with her mother's dead image.
Right. So, well, we're going to hear some of her mother's duets as we go out. Thanks for that. You're recommending it, I gather, from the way.
Stunning, yeah.
Okay, listen, that's all we've time for today, and I'd like to say thank you to absolutely everybody that contributed to the programme. Today's show was produced by Owen McLaughlin. Researchers are Michelle Brown and Andrew Fleming. Broadcasting coordinator was Emily Harley. Sound operator was Jamie Doyle, and the series producer is Rachel Graham.
Forget your troubles,
happy days,
come on, get happy,
I hear again the skies,
all the cares above are clear,
again.
Shout hallelujah,
so let's sing a song,
come on, get happy,
cheer again,
all again. Happy days are here again. The sun is shining.
The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Tesco, where even the little things make all the difference. Tesco, every little helps.